suspecting man while he's watching television. I think there is much you can do about our crisis in the humble role of housewife. I could wish you no better vocation than that. Thus the logic of the feminine mystique redefined the very nature of woman's problem. When woman was seen as a human being of limitless human potential equal to man, anything that kept her from realizing her full potential was a problem to be solved. Barriers to higher education and political participation, discrimination or prejudice in law or morality. But now that woman is seen only in terms of her sexual role, the barriers to the realization of her full potential, the prejudices which deny her full participation in the world, are no longer problems. The only problems now are those that might disturb her adjustment as a housewife. So career is a problem, education is a problem, political interest, even the very admission of women's intelligence and individuality is a problem. And finally, there is the problem that has no name, a vague, undefined wish for something more than washing dishes, ironing, punishing, and praising the children. In the women's magazines, it is solved either by dyeing one's hair blonde or by having another baby. Remember when we were all children, how we all planned to be something, says a young housewife in the Ladies' Home Journal, February 1960. Boasting that she has worn out 6 copies of Dr. Spock's baby care book in 7 years, she cries, I'm lucky, lucky, I'm so glad to be a woman. In one of these stories, Holiday, Mademoiselle, August 1949, a desperate young wife is ordered by her doctor to get out of the house one day a week. She goes shopping, tries on dresses, looks in the mirror wondering which one her husband Sam will like. Always Sam, like a Greek chorus in the back of her head. As if she herself hadn't a definiteness of her own, a clarity that was indisputably hers. Suddenly she couldn't make the difference between pleated and gored skirts of sufficient importance to fix her decision. She looked at herself in the full-length glass, tall, getting thicker around the hips, the lines of her face beginning to slip. She was 29, but she felt middle-aged, as if a great many years had passed and there wasn't very much yet to come. Which was ridiculous, for Ellen was only 3. There was her whole future to plan for, and perhaps another child. It was not a thing to be put off too long. When the young housewife in The Man Next to Me, Red Book, November 1948, discovers that her elaborate dinner party didn't help her husband get a raise after all, she is in despair. You should say I helped. You should say I'm good for something. Life was like a puzzle with the piece missing, and the piece was me, and I couldn't figure my place in it at all. So she dyes her hair blonde, and when her husband reacts satisfactorily in bed to the new blonde me, she felt a new sense of peace, as if I'd answered the question within myself. Over and over again, stories in women's magazines insist that women can know fulfillment only at the moment of giving birth to a child. They deny the years when she can no longer look forward to giving birth, even if she repeats that act over and over again. In the feminine mystique, there is no other way for a woman to dream of creation or of the future. There is no way she can even dream about herself, except as her children's mother, her husband's wife. And the documentary articles play back new young housewives grown up under the mystique, who do not have even that question within myself. Says one, described in How America Lives, Ladies' Home Journal, June 1959, if he doesn't want me to wear a certain color or a certain kind of dress, then I truly don't want to either. The thing is, whatever he has wanted is what I also want. I don't believe in 50-50 marriages. Giving up college and job to marry at 18, with no regrets, she never tried to enter into the discussion when the men were talking. She never disputed her husband in anything. She spent a great deal of time looking out the window at the snow, the rain, and the gradual emergence of the first crocuses. One great time passer and consolation was embroidery, tiny stitches in gold metal or silken thread, which require infinite concentration. There is no problem in the logic of the feminine mystique for such a woman who has no wishes of her own, who defines herself only as wife and mother. The problem, if there is one, can only be her children's or her husband's. It is the husband who complains to the marriage counselor, Red Book, June 1955. The way I see it, marriage takes two people, each living his own life, and then putting them together. Mary seems to think we both ought to live one life, mine. Mary insists on going with him to buy shirts and socks, tells the clerk his size and color. When he comes home at night, she asks with whom he ate lunch, where, what did he talk about. When he protests, she says, "But darling, I want to share your life. Be part of all you do, that's all. I want us to be one, the way it says in the marriage service." It doesn't seem reasonable to the husband that two people can ever be one the way Mary means it. It's just plain ridiculous on the face of it. Besides, I wouldn't like it. I don't want to be so bound to another person that I can't have a thought or an action that's strictly my own. The answer to Pete's problem, says Dr. Emily Mudd, the famous marriage counselor, is to make Mary feel she is living his life. Invite her to town to lunch with the people in his office once in a while, order his favorite veal dish for her, and maybe find her some healthy physical activity, like swimming, to drain off her excess energy. It is not Mary's problem that she has no life of her own. The ultimate in housewife happiness is finally achieved by the Texas housewife, described in How America Lives, Ladies' Home Journal, October 1960, who sits on a pale aqua satin sofa gazing out her picture window at the street. Even at this hour of the morning, it is barely 9 o'clock, she is wearing rouge, powder, and lipstick, and her cotton dress is immaculately fresh. She says proudly, "By 8:30 a.m., when my youngest goes to school, my whole house is clean and neat, and I am dressed for the day. I am free to play bridge, attend club meetings, or stay home and read, listen to Beethoven, and just plain loaf." Sometimes she washes and dries her hair before sitting down at a bridge table at 1:30. Mornings she is having bridge at her house are the busiest, for then she must get out the tables, cards, tallies, prepare fresh coffee, and organize lunch. During the winter months, she may play as often as 4 days a week, from 9:30 to 3 p.m. Janice is careful to be home before her son's return from school at 4 p.m. She is not frustrated, this new young housewife. An honor student at high school, married at 18, remarried and pregnant at 20, she has the house she spent 7 years dreaming and planning in detail. She is proud of her efficiency as a housewife, getting it all done by 8:30. She does the major house cleaning on Saturday when her husband fishes and her sons are busy with Boy Scouts. "There's nothing else to do, no bridge games. It's a long day for me." "I love my home," she says. The pale gray paint in her L-shaped living room and dining room is 5 years old, but still in perfect condition. The pale peach and yellow and aqua damask upholstery looks spotless after 8 years' wear. "Sometimes I feel too passive, too content," remarks Janice fondly, regarding the wristband of large family diamonds she wears even when the watch itself is being repaired. Her favorite possession is her four-poster spool bed with a pink taffeta canopy. "I feel just like Queen Elizabeth sleeping in that bed," she says happily. Her husband sleeps in another room, since he snores. "I'm so grateful for my blessings," she says. "Wonderful husband, handsome sons with dispositions to match, big comfortable house. I'm thankful for my good health and faith in God and such material possessions as 2 cars, 2 TVs, and 2 fireplaces. Staring uneasily at this image, I wonder if a few problems are not somehow better than this smiling, empty passivity. If they are happy, these young women who live the feminine mystique, then is this the end of the road? Or are the seeds of something worse than frustration inherent in this image? Is there a growing divergence between this image of woman and human reality? Consider as a symptom the increasing emphasis on glamour in the women's magazines. The housewife wearing eye makeup as she vacuums the floor, the honor of being a woman. Why does occupation housewife require such insistent glamorizing year after year? The strained glamour is in itself a question mark. The lady doth protest too much. The image of woman in another era required increasing prudishness to keep denying sex. This new image seems to require increasing mindlessness, increasing emphasis on things, 2 cars, 2 TVs, 2 fireplaces. Whole pages of women's magazines are filled with gargantuan vegetables, beets, cucumbers, green peppers, potatoes, described like a love affair. The very size of their print is raised until it looks like a first-grade primer. The new McCall's frankly assumes women are brainless, fluffy kittens. The Ladies' Home Journal, feverishly competing, procures rock and roller Pat Boone as a counselor to teenagers. Redbook and the others enlarge their own type size. Does the size of the print mean that the new young women, whom all the magazines are courting, have only first-grade minds, or does it try to hide the triviality of the content? Within the confines of what is now accepted as Woman's World, an editor may no longer be able to think of anything big to do except blow up a baked potato or describe a kitchen as if it were the Hall of Mirrors. He is, after all, forbidden by the mystique to deal with a big idea. But does it not occur to any of the men who run the women's magazines that their troubles may stem from the smallness of the image with which they are truncating women's minds? They are all in trouble today, the mass circulation magazines, vying fiercely with each other and television to deliver more and more millions of women who will buy the things their advertisers sell. Does this frantic race force the men who make the images to see women only as thing buyers? Does it force them to compete finally in emptying women's minds of human thought? The fact is, the troubles of the image makers seem to be increasing in direct proportion to the increasing mindlessness of their image. During the years in which that image has narrowed Woman's World down to the home, cut her role back to housewife, five of the mass circulation magazines geared to women have ceased publication. Others are on the brink. The growing boredom of women with the empty, narrow image of the women's magazines may be the most hopeful sign of the image's divorce from reality. But there are more violent symptoms on the part of women who are committed to that image. In 1960, the editors of a magazine specifically geared to the happy young housewife, or rather, to the new young couples, the wives are not considered separate from their husbands and children, ran an article asking, "Why Young Mothers Feel Trapped?" Redbook, September 1960. As a promotion stunt, they invited young mothers with such a problem to write in the details for $500. The editors were shocked to receive 24,000 replies. Can an image of woman be cut down to the point where it becomes itself a trap? At one of the major women's magazines, a woman editor, sensing that American housewives might be desperately in need of something to enlarge their world, tried for some months to convince her male colleagues to introduce a few ideas outside the home into the magazine. "We decided against it," the man who makes the final decision said. "Women are so completely divorced from the world of ideas in their lives now, they couldn't take it." Perhaps it is irrelevant to ask who divorced them. Perhaps these Frankensteins no longer have the power to stop the feminine monster they have created. I helped create this image. I have watched American women for 15 years try to conform to it, but I can no longer deny my own knowledge of its terrible implications. It is not a harmless image. There may be no psychological terms for the harm it is doing, but what happens when women try to live according to an image that makes them deny their minds? What happens when women grow up in an image that makes them deny the reality of the changing world? The material details of life, the daily burden of cooking and cleaning, of taking care of the physical needs of husband and children, these did indeed define a woman's world a century ago when Americans were pioneers and the American frontier lay in conquering the land. But the women who went west with the wagon trains also shared the pioneering purpose. Now the American frontiers are of the mind and of the spirit. Love and children and home are good, but they are not the whole world, even if most of the words now written for women pretend they are. Why should women accept this picture of a half-life instead of a share in the whole of human destiny? Why should women try to make housework something more instead of moving on the frontiers of their own time as American women moved beside their husbands on the old frontiers? A baked potato is not as big as the world, and vacuuming the living room floor with or without makeup is not work that takes enough thought or energy to challenge any woman's full capacity. Women are human beings, not stuffed dolls, not animals. Down through the ages, man has known that he was set apart from other animals by his mind's power to have an idea, a vision, and shape the future to it. He shares a need for food and sex with other animals, but when he loves as a man, and when he discovers and creates and shapes a future different from his past, he is a man, a human being. This is the real mystery. Why did so many American women, with the ability and education to discover and create, go back home again to look for something more in housework and rearing children? For, paradoxically, in the same 15 years in which the spirited new woman was replaced by the happy housewife, the boundaries of the human world have widened. The pace of world change has quickened, and the very nature of human reality has become increasingly free from biological and material necessity. Does the mystique keep American woman from growing with the world? Does it force her to deny reality, as a woman in a mental hospital must deny reality to believe she is a queen? Does it doom women to be displaced persons, if not virtual schizophrenics, in our complex, changing world? It is more than a strange paradox that as all professions are finally open to women in America, career woman has become a dirty word. That as higher education becomes available to any woman with the capacity for it, education for women has become so suspect that more and more drop out of high school and college to marry and have babies. That as so many roles in modern society become theirs for the taking, women so insistently confine themselves to one role. Why, with the removal of all the legal, political, economic, and educational barriers that once kept woman from being man's equal, a person in her own right, an individual free to develop her own potential, should she accept this new image which insists she is not a person, but a woman, by definition barred from the freedom of human existence and a voice in human destiny? The feminine mystique is so powerful that women grow up no longer knowing that they have the desires and capacities the mystique forbids. But such a mystique does not fasten itself on a whole nation in a few short years, reversing the trends of a century without cause. What gives the mystique its power? Why did women go home again? Chapter 3, The Crisis in Woman's Identity. I discovered a strange thing interviewing women of my own generation over the past 10 years. When we were growing up, many of us could not see ourselves beyond the age of 21. We had no image of our own future, of ourselves as women. I remember the stillness of a spring afternoon on the Smith campus in 1942 when I came to a frightening dead end in my own vision of the future. A few days earlier, I had received a notice that I had won a graduate fellowship. During the congratulations, underneath my excitement, I felt a strange uneasiness. There was a question that I did not want to think about. Is this really what I want to be? The question shut me off, cold and alone, from the girls talking and studying on the sunny hillside behind the college house. I thought I was going to be a psychologist. But if I wasn't sure, what did I want to be? I felt the future closing in, and I could not see myself in it at all. I had no image of myself stretching beyond college. I had come at 17 from a Midwestern town, an unsure girl. The wide horizons of the world and the life of the mind had been opened to me. I had begun to know who I was and what I wanted to do. I could not go back now. I could not go home again to the life of my mother and the women of our town, bound to home, bridge, shopping, children, husband, charity, clothes. But now that the time had come to make my own future, to take the deciding step, I suddenly did not know what I wanted to be. I took the fellowship, but the next spring, under the alien California sun of another campus, the question came again, and I could not put it out of my mind. I had won another fellowship that would have committed me to research for my doctorate, to a career as a professional psychologist. Is this really what I want to be? The decision now truly terrified me. I lived in a terror of indecision for days, unable to think of anything else. The question was not important, I told myself. No question was important to me that year but love. We walked in the Berkeley Hills and a boy said, "Nothing can come of this between us. I'll never win a fellowship like yours." Did I think I would be choosing, irrevocably, the cold loneliness of that afternoon if I went on? I gave up the fellowship in relief. But for years afterward, I could not read a word of the science that once I had thought of as my future life's work. The reminder of its loss was too painful. I could never explain, hardly knew myself, why I gave up this career. I lived in the present, working on newspapers with no particular plan. I married, had children, lived according to the feminine mystique as a suburban housewife. But still the question haunted me. I could sense no purpose in my life. I could find no peace until I finally faced it and worked out my own answer. I discovered, talking to Smith seniors in 1959, that the question is no less terrifying to girls today. Only they answer it now in a way that my generation found, after half a lifetime, not to be an answer at all. These girls, mostly seniors, were sitting in the living room of the college house having coffee. It was not too different from such an evening when I was a senior, except that many more of the girls wore rings on their left hands. I asked the ones around me what they planned to be. The engaged ones spoke of weddings, apartments, getting a job as a secretary while husband finished school. The others, after a hostile silence, gave vague answers about this job or that, graduate study, but no one had any real plans. A blonde with a ponytail asked me the next day if I had believed the things they had said. None of it was true, she told me. We don't like to be asked what we want to do. None of us know. None of us even like to think about it. The ones who are going to be married right away are the lucky ones. They don't have to think about it. But I noticed that night that many of the engaged girls, sitting silently around the fire while I asked the others about jobs, had also seemed angry about something. They don't want to think about not going on, my ponytailed informant said. They know they're not going to use their education. They'll be wives and mothers. You can say you're going to keep on reading and be interested in the community, but that's not the same. You won't really go on. It's a disappointment to know you're going to stop now and not go on and use it. In counterpoint, I heard the words of a woman 15 years after she left college, a doctor's wife, mother of three, who said over coffee in her New England kitchen, "The tragedy was, nobody ever looked us in the eye and said you have to decide what you want to do with your life, besides being your husband's wife and children's mother. I never thought it through until I was 36 and my husband was so busy with his practice that he couldn't entertain me every night. The three boys were in school all day. I kept on trying to have babies despite an RH discrepancy. After two miscarriages, they said I must stop. I thought that my own growth and evolution were over. I always knew as a child that I was going to grow up and go to college and then get married, and that's as far as a girl has to think. After that, your husband determines and fills your life. It wasn't until I got so lonely as the doctor's wife and kept screaming at the kids because they didn't fill my life that I realized I had to make my own life. I still had to decide what I wanted to be. I hadn't finished evolving at all. But it took me 10 years to think it through. The feminine mystique permits, even encourages, women to ignore the question of their identity. The mystique says they can answer the question, "Who am I?" by saying, "Tom's wife, Mary's mother." But I don't think the mystique would have such power over American women if they did not fear to face this terrifying blank, which makes them unable to see themselves after 21. The truth is, and how long it has been true, I'm not sure, but it was true in my generation, and it is true of girls growing up today. An American woman no longer has a private image to tell her who she is, or can be, or wants to be. The public image in the magazines and television commercials is designed to sell washing machines, cake mixes, deodorants, detergents, rejuvenating face creams, hair tints. But the power of that image, on which companies spend millions of dollars for television time and ad space, comes from this. American women no longer know who they are. They are solely in need of a new image to help them find their identity. As the motivational researchers keep telling the advertisers, American women are so unsure of who they should be that they look to this glossy public image to decide every detail of their lives. They look for the image they will no longer take from their mothers. In my generation, many of us knew that we did not want to be like our mothers, even when we loved them. We cannot help but see their disappointment. Did we understand or only resent the sadness, the emptiness that made them hold too fast to us, try to live our lives, run our father's lives, spend their days shopping or yearning for things that never seemed to satisfy them, no matter how much money they cost? Strangely, many mothers who loved their daughters, and mine was one, did not want their daughters to grow up like them either. They knew we needed something more. But even if they urged, insisted, fought to help us educate ourselves, even if they talked with yearning of careers that were not open to them, they could not give us an image of what we could be. They could only tell us that their lives were too empty, tied to home, that children, cooking, clothes, bridge, and charities were not enough. A mother might tell her daughter, spell it out, "Don't be just a housewife like me." But that daughter, sensing that her mother was too frustrated to savor the love of her husband and children might feel, "I will succeed where my mother failed. I will fulfill myself as a woman," and never read the lesson of her mother's life. Recently, interviewing high school girls who had started out full of promise and talent but suddenly stopped their education, I began to see new dimensions to the problem of feminine conformity. These girls, it seemed at first, were merely following the typical curve of feminine adjustment. Earlier interested in geology or poetry, they now were interested only in being popular. To get boys to like them, they had concluded, it was better to be like all the other girls. On closer examination, I found that these girls were so terrified of becoming like their mothers that they could not see themselves at all. They were afraid to grow up. They had to copy in identical detail the composite image of the popular girl, denying what was best in themselves out of fear of femininity as they saw it in their mothers. One of these girls, 17 years old, told me, "I want so badly to feel like the other girls. I never get over this feeling of being a neophyte, not initiated. When I get up and have to cross a room, it's like I'm a beginner or have some terrible affliction and I'll never learn. I go to the local hangout after school and sit there for hours talking about clothes and hairdos and the twist, and I'm not that interested, so it's an effort. But I found out I can make them like me, just do what they do, dress like them, talk like them, not do things that are different. I guess I even started to make myself not different inside. I used to write poetry. The guidance office says I have this creative ability and I should be at the top of the class and have a great future. But things like that aren't what you need to be popular. The important thing for a girl is to be popular. Now I go out with boy after boy, and it's such an effort because I'm not myself with them. It makes you feel even more alone, and besides, I'm afraid of where it's going to lead. Pretty soon, all my differences will be smoothed out, and I'll be the kind of girl that could be a housewife. I don't want to think of growing up. If I had children, I'd want them to stay the same age. If I had to watch them grow up, I'd see myself growing older, and I wouldn't want to. My mother says she can't sleep at night. She's sick with worry over what I might do. When I was little, she wouldn't let me cross the street alone, long after the other kids did. I can't see myself as being married and having children. It's as if I wouldn't have any personality myself. My mother's like a rock that's been smoothed by the waves, like a void. She's put so much into her family that there's nothing left, and she resents us because she doesn't get enough in return. But sometimes it seems like there's nothing there. My mother doesn't serve any purpose except cleaning the house. She isn't happy and she doesn't make my father happy. If she didn't care about his children at all, it would have the same effect as caring too much. It makes you want to do the opposite. I don't think it's really love. When I was little and I ran in all excited to tell her I'd learn how to stand on my head, she was never listening. Lately, I look into the mirror and I'm so afraid I'm going to look like my mother. It frightens me to catch myself being like her in gestures or speech or anything. I'm not like her in so many ways, but if I'm like her in this one way, perhaps I'll turn out like my mother after all, and that terrifies me. And so the 17-year-old was so afraid of being a woman like her mother that she turned her back on all the things in herself and all the opportunities that would have made her a different woman, to copy from the outside the popular girls. And finally, in panic at losing herself, she turned her back on her own popularity and defied the conventional good behavior that would have won her a college scholarship. For lack of an image that would help her grow up as a woman true to herself, she retreated into the beatnik vacuum. Another girl, a college junior from South Carolina, told me, "I don't want to be interested in a career I'll have to give up. My mother wanted to be a newspaper reporter from the time she was 12, and I've seen her frustration for 20 years. I don't want to be interested in world affairs. I don't want to be interested in anything beside my home and being a wonderful wife and mother. Maybe education is a liability. Even the brightest boys at home want just a sweet, pretty girl. Only sometimes I wonder how it would feel to be able to stretch and stretch and stretch and learn all you want and not have to hold yourself back." Her mother, almost all our mothers, were housewives, though many had started or yearned for or regretted giving up careers. Whatever they told us, we, having eyes and ears and mind and heart, knew that their lives were somehow empty. We did not want to be like them, and yet what other model did we have? The only other kind of women I knew growing up were the old maid high school teachers, the librarian, the one-woman doctor in our town who cut her hair like a man, and a few of my college professors. None of these women lived in the warm center of life as I had known it at home. Many had not married or had children. I dreaded being like them. Even the ones who taught me truly to respect my own mind and use it to feel that I had a part in the world. I never knew a woman when I was growing up who used her mind, played her own part in the world, and also loved and had children. I think that this has been the unknown heart of woman's problem in America for a long time, this lack of a private image. Public images that defy reason and have very little to do with women themselves have had the power to shape too much of their lives. These images would not have such power if women were not suffering a crisis of identity. The strange, terrifying jumping-off point that American women reach at 18, 21, 25, 41 has been noticed for many years by sociologists, psychologists, analysts, educators, but I think it has not been understood for what it is. It has been called a discontinuity in cultural conditioning. It has been called woman's role crisis. It has been blamed on the education which made American girls grow up feeling free and equal to boys, playing baseball, riding bicycles, conquering geometry and college boards, going away to college, going out in the world to get a job, living alone in an apartment in New York or Chicago or San Francisco, testing and discovering their own powers in the world. All this gave girls the feeling they could be and do whatever they wanted to, with the same freedom as boys, the critics said. It did not prepare them for their role as women. The crisis comes when they are forced to adjust to this role. Today's high rate of emotional distress and breakdown among women in their 20s and 30s is usually attributed to this role crisis. If girls were educated for their role as women, they would not suffer this crisis, the adjusters say. But I think they have seen only half the truth. What if the terror a girl faces at 21 when she must decide who she will be, is simply the terror of growing up. Growing up as women were not permitted to grow before. What if the terror a girl faces at 21 is the terror of freedom to decide her own life, with no one to order which path she will take, the freedom and the necessity to take paths women before were not able to take? What if those who chose the path of feminine adjustment, evading this terror by marrying at 18, losing themselves in having babies and the details of housekeeping, are simply refusing to grow up, to face the question of their own identity? Mine was the first college generation to run head-on into the new mystique of feminine fulfillment. Before then, while most women did indeed end up as housewives and mothers, the point of education was to discover the life of the mind, to pursue truth, and to take a place in the world. There was a sense, already dulling when I went to college, that we would be new women. Our world would be much larger than home. 40% of my college class at Smith had career plans, but I remember how, even then, some of the seniors, suffering the pangs of that bleak fear of the future, envied the few who escaped it by getting married right away. The ones we envied then are suffering that terror now at 40. Never have decided what kind of woman I am. Too much personal life in college. Wish I'd studied more science, history, government, gone deeper into philosophy, one wrote on an alumni questionnaire 15 years later. Still trying to find the rock to build on. Wish I had finished college. I got married instead. Wish I developed a deeper and more creative life of my own, and that I hadn't become engaged and married at 19. Having expected the ideal in marriage, including a 100% devoted husband, it was a shock to find this isn't the way it is, wrote a mother of six. Many of the younger generation of wives who marry early have never suffered this lonely terror. They thought they did not have to choose to look into the future and plan what they wanted to do with their lives. They had only to wait to be chosen, marking time passively until the husband, the babies, the new house decided what the rest of their lives would be. They slid easily into their sexual role as women before they knew who they were themselves. It is these women who suffer most the problem that has no name. It is my thesis that the core of the problem for women today is not sexual, but a problem of identity, a stunting or evasion of growth that is perpetuated by the feminine mystique. It is my thesis that as the Victorian culture did not permit women to accept or gratify their basic sexual needs, our culture does not permit women to accept or gratify their basic need to grow and fulfill their potentialities as human beings, a need which is not solely defined by their sexual role. Biologists have recently discovered a youth serum, which, if fed to young caterpillars in the larva state, will keep them from ever maturing into moths. They will live out their lives as caterpillars. The expectations of feminine fulfillment that are fed to women by magazines, television, movies, and books that popularize psychological half-truths and by parents, teachers, and counselors who accept the feminine mystique operate as a kind of youth serum, keeping most women in the state of sexual larvae, preventing them from achieving the maturity of which they are capable. And there is increasing evidence that woman's failure to grow to complete identity has hampered rather than enriched her sexual fulfillment, virtually doomed her to be castrative to her husband and sons, and caused neuroses, or problems as yet unnamed as neuroses, equal to those caused by sexual repression. There have been identity crises for man at all the crucial turning points in human history, though those who lived through them did not give them that name. It is only in recent years that the theorists of psychology, sociology, and theology have isolated this problem and given it a name. But it is considered a man's problem. It is defined for man as the crisis of growing up, of choosing his identity, the decision as to what one is and is going to be, in the words of the brilliant psychoanalyst Erik H. Erikson. I have called the major crisis of adolescence the identity crisis. It occurs in that period of the life cycle when each youth must forge for himself some central perspective and direction, some working unity out of the effective remnants of his childhood and the hopes of his anticipated adulthood. He must detect some meaningful resemblance between what he has come to see in himself and what his sharpened awareness tells him others judge and expect him to be. In some people, in some classes, at some periods in history, the crisis will be minimal. In other people, classes, and periods, the crisis will be clearly marked off as a crucial period, a kind of second birth, apt to be aggravated either by widespread neuroticisms or by pervasive ideological unrest. In this sense, the identity crisis of one man's life may reflect or set off a rebirth or new stage in the growing up of mankind. In some periods of his history and in some phases of his life cycle, man needs a new ideological orientation as surely and sorely as he must have air and food, says Erikson, focusing new light on the crisis of the young Martin Luther who left a Catholic monastery at the end of the Middle Ages to forge a new identity for himself and Western man. The search for identity is not new, however, in American thought. Though in every generation, each man who writes about it discovers it anew. In America, from the beginning, it has somehow been understood that men must thrust into the future. The pace has always been too rapid for man's identity to stand still. In every generation, many men have suffered misery, unhappiness, and uncertainty because they could not take the image of the man they wanted to be from their fathers. The search for identity of the young man who can't go home again has always been a major theme of American writers, and it has always been considered right in America, good, for men to suffer these agonies of growth, to search for and find their own identities. The farm boy went to the city. The garment maker's son became a doctor. Abraham Lincoln taught himself to read. These were more than rags-to-riches stories. They were an integral part of the American dream. The problem for many was money, race, color, class, which barred them from choice. Not what they would be if they were free to choose. Even today, a young man learns soon enough that he must decide who he wants to be. If he does not decide in junior high, in high school, in college, he must somehow come to terms with it by 25 or 30, or he is lost. But this search for identity is seen as a greater problem now because more and more boys cannot find images in our culture from their fathers or other men to help them in their search. The old frontiers have been conquered, and the boundaries of the new are not so clearly marked. More and more young men in America today suffer an identity crisis for want of any image of man worth pursuing, for want of a purpose that truly realizes their human abilities. But why have theorists not recognized this same identity crisis in women? In terms of the old conventions and the new feminine mystique, women are not expected to grow up to find out who they are, to choose their human identity. Anatomy is woman's destiny, say the theorists of femininity. The identity of woman is determined by our biology. But is it? More and more women are asking themselves this question. As if they were waking from a coma, they ask, where am I? What am I doing here? For the first time in their history, women are becoming aware of an identity crisis in their own lives, a crisis which began many generations ago, has grown worse with each succeeding generation, and will not end until they, or their daughters, turn an unknown corner and make of themselves and their lives the new image that so many women now so desperately need. In a sense that goes beyond any one woman's life, I think this is the crisis of women growing up, a turning point from an immaturity that has been called femininity to full human identity. I think women had to suffer this crisis of identity, which began 100 years ago, and have to suffer it still today, simply to become fully human. Chapter 4, The Passionate Journey. It was the need for a new identity that started women a century ago on that passionate journey, that vilified, misinterpreted journey away from home. It has been popular in recent years to laugh at feminism as one of history's dirty jokes, to pity, sniggering, those old-fashioned feminists who fought for women's rights to higher education, careers, the vote. They were neurotic victims of penis envy who wanted to be men, it is said now. In battling for women's freedom to participate in the major work and decisions of society as the equals of men, they deny their very nature as women, which fulfills itself only through sexual passivity, acceptance of male domination, and nurturing motherhood. But if I am not mistaken, it is this first journey which holds the clue to much that has happened to women since. It is one of the strange blind spots of contemporary psychology not to recognize the reality of the passion that moved these women to leave home in search of a new identity, or, staying home, to yearn bitterly for something more. Theirs was an act of rebellion, a violent denial of the identity of women as it was then defined. It was the need for a new identity that led those passionate feminists to forge new trails for women. Some of those trails were unexpectedly rough, some were dead ends, and some may have been false, but the need for women to find new trails was real. The problem of identity was new for women then, truly new. The feminists were pioneering on the front edge of woman's evolution. They had to prove that women were human. They had to shatter, violently if necessary, the decorative Dresden figurine that represented the ideal woman of the last century. They had to prove that woman was not a passive, empty mirror, not a frilly, useless decoration, not a mindless animal, not a thing to be disposed of by others, incapable of a voice in her own existence, before they could even begin to fight for the rights women needed to become the human equals of men. Changeless woman, childish woman, a woman's place is in the home, they were told. But man was changing. His place was in the world, and his world was widening. Woman was being left behind. Anatomy was her destiny. She might die giving birth to one baby, or live to be 35 giving birth to 12, while man controlled his destiny with that part of his anatomy which no other animal had, his mind. Women also had minds. They also had the human need to grow. But the work that fed life and moved it forward was no longer done at home, and women were not trained to understand and work in the world. Confined to the home, a child among her children, passive, no part of her existence under her own control, a woman could only exist by pleasing man. She was wholly dependent on his protection in a world that she had no share in making, man's world. She could never grow up to ask the simple human question, "Who am I? What do I want?" Even if man loved her as a child, a doll, a decoration, even if he gave her rubies, satin, velvets, even if she was warm in her house, safe with her children, would she not yearn for something more? She was, at that time, so completely defined as object by man, never herself as subject, I, that she was not even expected to enjoy or participate in the act of sex. He took his pleasure with her. He had his way with her, as the sayings went. Is it so hard to understand that emancipation, the right to full humanity, was important enough to generations of women, still alive or only recently dead, that some fought with their fists and went to jail and even died for it? And for the right to human growth, some women denied their own sex, the desire to love and be loved by a man, and to bear children. It is a strangely unquestioned perversion of history that the passion and fire of the feminist movement came from man-hating, embittered, sex-starved spinsters, from castrating, unsexed non-women who burned with such envy for the male organ that they wanted to take it away from all men or destroy them, demanding rights only because they lacked the power to love as women. Mary Wollstonecraft, Angelina Grimke, Ernestine Rose, Margaret Fuller, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Julia Ward Howe, Margaret Sanger, all loved, were loved, and married. Many seem to have been as passionate in their relations with lover and husband in an age when passion in woman was as forbidden as intelligence, as they were in their battle for woman's chance to grow to full human stature. But if they, and those like Susan Anthony, whom fortune or bitter experience turned away from marriage, fought for a chance for woman to fulfill herself, not in relation to man, but as individual, it was from a need as real and burning as the need for love. "What woman needs," said Margaret Fuller, "is not as a woman to act or rule, but as a nature to grow, as an intellect to discern, as a soul to live freely, and unimpeded to unfold such powers as were given her." The feminists had only one model, one image, one vision of a full and free human being, man. For until very recently, only men, though not all men, had the freedom and the education necessary to realize their full abilities, to pioneer and create and discover and map new trails for future generations. Only men had the vote, the freedom to shape the major decisions of society. Only men had the freedom to love and enjoy love and decide for themselves in the eyes of their God the problems of right and wrong. Did women want these freedoms because they wanted to be men? Or did they want them because they also were human? That this is what feminism was all about was seen symbolically by Henrik Ibsen. When he said in a play, A Doll's House, in 1879, that a woman was simply a human being, he struck a new note in literature. Thousands of women in middle-class Europe and America in that Victorian time saw themselves in Nora. And in 1960, almost a century later, millions of American housewives who watched the play on television also saw themselves as they heard Nora say, "You have always been so kind to me, but our home has been nothing but a playroom. I have been your doll wife, just as at home I was Papa's doll child, and here the children have been my dolls. I thought it great fun when you played with me, just as they thought it fun when I played with them. That is what our marriage has been, Torvald. How am I fitted to bring up the children? There is another task I must undertake first. I must try and educate myself. You are not the man to help me in that. I must do that for myself. And that is why I am going to leave you now. I must stand quite alone if I am to understand myself and everything about me. It is for that reason that I cannot remain with you any longer." Her shocked husband reminds Nora that woman's most sacred duties are her duties to her husband and children. "Before all else, you are a wife and mother," he says, and Nora answers, "I believe that before all else, I am a reasonable human being, just as you are, or, at all events, that I must try and become one. I know quite well, Torvald, that most people would think you right, and that views of that kind are to be found in books. But I can no longer content myself with what most people say or with what is found in books. I must think over things for myself and get to understand them." It is a cliche of our own time that women spent half a century fighting for rights and the next half wondering whether they wanted them after all. Rights have a dull sound of people who have grown up after they have been won. But like Nora, the feminists had to win those rights before they could begin to live and love as human beings. Not very many women then, or even now, dare to leave the only security they knew, dare to turn their backs on their homes and husbands to begin Nora's search. But a great many, then as now, must have found their existence as housewives so empty that they could no longer savor the love of husband and children. Some of them, and even a few men who realized that half the human race was denied the right to become fully human, set out to change the conditions that held women in bondage. Those conditions were summed up by the first Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848, as woman's grievances against man. "He has compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she has no voice. He has made her, if married, in the eyes of the law, civilly dead. He has taken from her all right to property, even to the wages she earns. In the covenant of marriage, she is compelled to promise obedience to her husband, he becoming to all intents and purposes her master, the law giving him power to deprive her of her liberty and to administer chastisement. He closes against her all the avenues of wealth and distinction which he considers most honorable to himself. As a teacher of theology, medicine, or law, she is not known. He has denied her the facilities for obtaining a thorough education, all colleges being closed against her. He has created a false public sentiment by giving to the world a different code of morals for men and women, by which moral delinquencies, which exclude women from society, are not only tolerated, but deemed of little account to man. He has usurped the prerogative of Jehovah himself, claiming it as his right to assign for her a sphere of action, when that belongs to her conscience and to her God. He has endeavored in every way that he could to destroy her confidence in her own powers, to lessen her self-respect, and to make her willing to lead a dependent and abject life." It was these conditions which the feminists set out to abolish a century ago that made women what they were, feminine as it was then and is still defined. It is hardly a coincidence that the struggle to free woman began in America on the heels of the Revolutionary War and grew strong with the movement to free the slaves. Thomas Paine, the spokesman for the Revolution, was among the first to condemn in 1775 the position of women, even in countries where they may be esteemed the most happy, constrained in their desires, in the disposal of their goods, robbed of freedom and will by the laws, the slaves of opinion. During the Revolution, some 10 years before Mary Wollstonecraft spearheaded the feminist movement in England, An American woman, Judith Sargent Murray, said women needed knowledge to envision new goals and grow by reaching for them. In 1837, the year Mount Holyoke opened its doors to give women their first chance at education equal to man's, American women were also holding their first national anti-slavery convention in New York. The women who formerly launched the women's rights movement at Seneca Falls met each other when they were refused seats at an anti-slavery convention in London. Shut off behind a curtain in the gallery, Elizabeth Stanton, on her honeymoon, and Lucretia Mott, demure mother of five, decided that it was not only the slaves who needed to be liberated. Whenever, wherever in the world there has been an upsurge of human freedom, women have won a share of it for themselves. Sex did not fight the French Revolution, free the slaves in America, overthrow the Russian Tsar, drive the British out of India. But when the idea of human freedom moves the minds of men, it also moves the minds of women. The cadences of the Seneca Falls Declaration came straight from the Declaration of Independence. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that they have hitherto occupied, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal. Feminism was not a dirty joke. The feminist revolution had to be fought because women, quite simply, were stopped at a stage of evolution far short of their human capacity. The domestic function of woman does not exhaust her powers, the Reverend Theodore Parker preached in Boston in 1853. To make one half the human race consume its energies in the functions of housekeeper, wife, and mother is a monstrous waste of the most precious material God ever made. And running like a bright and sometimes dangerous thread through the history of the feminist movement was also the idea that equality for woman was necessary to free both man and woman for true sexual fulfillment. For the degradation of woman also degraded marriage, love, all relations between man and woman. After the sexual revolution, said Robert Del Owen, then will the monopoly of sex perish with other unjust monopolies, and women will not be restricted to one virtue and one passion and one occupation. The women and men who started that revolution anticipated no small amount of misconception, misrepresentation, and ridicule. And they got it. The first to speak out in public for women's rights in America, Fanny Wright, daughter of a Scotch nobleman, and Ernestine Rose, daughter of a rabbi, were called, respectively, Red Harlot of Infidelity and Woman 1,000 times Below a Prostitute. The declaration at Seneca Falls brought such an outcry of revolution, insurrection among women, the reign of petticoats, blasphemy from newspapers and clergymen that the faint-hearted withdrew their signatures. Lurid reports of free love and legalized adultery competed with fantasies of court sessions, church sermons, and surgical operations interrupted while a lady lawyer or minister or doctor hastily presented her husband with a baby. At every step of the way, the feminists had to fight the conception that they were violating the God-given nature of woman. Clergymen interrupted women's rights conventions, waving Bibles and quoting from the scriptures. St. Paul said, "And the head of every woman is man. Let your women be silent in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in the church. But I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence, for Adam was first formed, then Eve." St. Peter said, "Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands." To give women equal rights would destroy that milder, gentler nature, which not only makes them shrink from, but disqualifies them for the turmoil and battle of public life, a senator from New Jersey intoned piously in 1866. They have a higher and holier mission. It is in rhetoricy to make the character of coming men. Their mission is at home by their blandishments and their love, to assuage the passions of men as they come in from the battle of life, and not themselves by joining in the contest to add fuel to the very flames. They do not appear to be satisfied with having unsexed themselves, but they desire to unsex every female in the land, said a New York assemblyman who opposed one of the first petitions for a married woman's right to property and earnings. Since God created man as the representative of the race, then took from his side the material for woman's creation, and returned her to his side in